Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, Tuesday is primary election day in Kentucky with congressional, state, and local races all on the ballot. And that's what we're going to talk about here in our first segment. Joining us to set the stage for the Kentucky primary are Joe Sonka of Leo Weekly, Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, and WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Welcome, guys.
Rick.
All right, let's start with the congressional races. And I guess the highest profile and the most hotly contested race is up in northern Kentucky in the 4th District. All three of you guys have been covering this. Philip, Republican Jeff Davis is retiring, and there is a crowded GOP field looking to succeed him.
Even though it's a crowded field, I think everyone agrees that the race is really between three candidates, that being Thomas Massie, Gary Moore, and State Representative Alicia Webb Edgington. At this point, I think it's safe to say that we weren't really sure who the favorite was, but now that U.S. Senator Rand Paul has endorsed Thomas Massie, I think that we're beginning to see Massie sort of take the lead here in the stretch, and it's really his race to lose in many people's minds. I'm not really sure if that's the general consensus, but I think that the ad – now, I haven't seen the Paul ad on television.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it online. I haven't seen it on TV. So the question is, how much is a television ad that doesn't air on TV worth? But to have U.S. Senator Rand Paul in your pocket as an endorsement, I think, means pretty much that Massie is the favorite at this point.
And is Davis, Congressman Davis, endorsing anyone?
Yeah, he's endorsed Alicia Webb Edgington, and that was kind of the high moment of her campaign so far. She rolled out a double endorsement of Davis and Bunning and former U.S. Senator Jim Bunning, and that was kind of really high, but she hasn't done anything since that. I mean, she hasn't put that endorsement into a radio or TV ad that I'm aware of. I think it's made it to a few mail pieces, but those only go so far. And so she's kind of – that was the high moment of her campaign, and now she's kind of gone back down. It's almost a two-person race between Massie and Moore, and I think it's safe to say that Massie is the front runner, even though he hasn't been able to get that Rand Paul ad on air. He's had two super PACs that have basically just trashed his opponent. I mean, if you watch the network news at all you're seeing is this Liberty for All super PAC, every commercial break, running an ad against Gary Moore and Alicia Webb Edgington.
And the Tea Party is extremely strong in the 4th District, and that is Thomas Massie's base. And I think even before Rand Paul came out and endorsed him, I think he was the favorite among the candidates. And if that ad does get on the air, then I think it's pretty much wrapped up that he's going to be the congressman.
Is it assumed that this seat will stay in Republican hands after November?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a very slim chance that, you know, Massie could have the effect that other Tea Partiers have had. But this is a Republican district. I mean, what it's going to take for it not to be Republicans is Massey's going to have to come out and say some wacky things. Second of all, Gary Moore, Alicia Webb Edgington, and all the other candidates are basically going to have to throw up their hands and say, this guy is not right. We'd rather put a Democrat in office for 2 years and win this seat back in 2014, which I'm not sure that's going to happen. There's probably going to be a lot of hurting. And then the Democrats are going to have to really fund some money in that. It's almost a no-win situation. I would put it at 10% or under.
I would say it's doubtful that the Kentucky Democratic Party is going to put any resource into that race because it's such a long shot, and they don't typically like to support liberal candidates. Like, I assume Adkins is going to win that primary, and it's doubtful that they're going to put a lot of effort behind him.
And if you look at the National Party, I mean, the Democrats need 25 seats. Kentucky 4 is not one of those seats that they're counting on getting. So, mm-hmm. As Joe said, not only is this Democratic candidate not going to get much support from the Kentucky Democratic Party, very unlikely you'll see the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee step in with any sort of resources as well.
Bill Adkins, one of the Democrats, and Greg Frank, the other. So there's two candidates.
That's
on
right.
The Democratic side.
That's right. And Adkins is probably going to be the winner of that primary. I think Frank is actually kind of more of a Tea Party Democrat. He's got a lot of Tea Party support, so it'd be interesting to see if he did make it and Massie made it. I mean, I think that's a no-brainer. Massie would probably win all that Tea Party support. But that would just be interesting if the dynamics change from what we're talking about. Adkins already has, you know, all the labor support here in Louisville, a lot of labor support up there in northern Kentucky. All bets are that he's the nominee.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. We're talking about Tuesday's Kentucky primary with Joe Sonka of Leo Weekly, Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, and WFPL's Philip M. Bailey. Let's go out to the 6th District for just a moment. Ben Chandler, the Democrat unopposed incumbent, but there are three Republicans running in the primary, and including his previous opponent, Andy Barr.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Andy Barr is probably going to be the nominee. I mean, outside of the 4th District, there's the congressional primaries. There's not a lot of competitiveness there. But Andy Barr does have, I think, two Tea Party guys, one more libertarian, that are kind of flanking him, just almost out of, they feel like they have to get their conversation, you know, their issues in the conversation. But Barr is likely the nominee. He's already been promoted to the top level for the National Republican congressional campaign. He's one of their young guns. It's something that they're going to take a focus on. What's going to be interesting, and Joe or Philip, you all can back me up on this, is that redistricting has really shored up Ben Chandler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. They've added more Democratic counties to the east and really shut it off some conservative counties. So even though that was a very tight race last time, Chandler is really looking like the favorite coming out of coming into the general election. And I would say that he's looking much better than he was, especially with the atmosphere in 2012 being much different than 2010, when that was a very Republican wave year.
And Chandler has also done an excellent job, a la Steve Beshear, of distancing himself from President Obama and his agenda. Really, I would say it's debatable if Chandler's even running as a Democrat. I mean, he's sort of running as Ben Chandler almost, like this sort of single-partied congressman who hasn't really done much politically one way or the other, hasn't really chimed in on some of the bigger issues, whether facing the state or even issues nationally that would pertain to Kentucky. So he's done an excellent job of sort of keeping himself under the radar. I'm not even sure what Barr's narrative is this year. It was obviously the Tea Party narrative 2 years ago, but what is the argument against Ben Chandler in 2012? I'm not hearing it from Republicans at large in the state or from the Barr campaign.
You know, I'm not sure that he has that narrative yet, and that's what hurt him. I mean, that would probably cost him 600 votes, is not having a real narrative other than, you know, this is a Republican year and we need to kick Ben Chandler out. On the flip side, what hurt Chandler in 2010 is I believe a lot of Democrats, a lot of your hardcore Lexington Democrats, liberal Democrats, sat on their hands and did not give him the support. And if he continues to distance himself from Obama in a year where we have a presidential election, and those voters are definitely coming out in 2012 to try to get Barack Obama reelected, does that hurt him? Do they skip his race?
I think what's going to help Chandler with those voters, I think, is taking on the Ryan plan, which Andy Barr has wholeheartedly endorsed, which would basically end the way what we know Medicare as. It would drastically change it. So I think he's going to play that up throughout the general election and hope that traditional Democrats come out.
Yeah, I think that's Chandler's main thing, has always been traditional Democrats, particularly in the around the Frankfort area in particular, in central Kentucky, state workers. I mean, that's been his base, and his base has only been enlarged. And so I'm not going to say he doesn't need those liberals, voters from Lexington, but if they stay home, I think he can still pull it out against Barr, as he did 2 years ago.
Elsewhere in the state, Ed Whitfield, the Republican in the 1st District, is unopposed. Two Democrats running for his seat. Hal Rogers in the 5th, also unopposed. Two Democrats seeking the nomination for his seat as well. Here in the 3rd, John Yarmuth, the incumbent unopposed. Brooks Wicker, the Republican, Philip, is going to be the nominee, but has raised very little money so
far.
Well,
Yarmuth actually does have a slight challenge with Burrell Farnsley. I believe he is in the race.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Burrell.
That isn't hard. But the issue with, I guess, the Democratic in District 3 here in Kentucky really is what happened to the Republican Party in Jefferson County? I mean, I don't, and Joe, you might be able to chime in on this. I remember some of the Tea Party rallies late last year and really up until, you know, the governor's race really started kicking up. Republicans around here were saying, no, there's going to be a lot of candidates who are going to jump in, and you're going to see some high-quality candidates challenge Yarmuth, challenge the Obama agenda, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was just Brooks Wicker, who has fundraising numbers show a lackluster campaign compared to that of the war chest of John Yarmuth. That could all change, obviously, as Mr. Wicker has pointed out. Say, pay attention to the June quarterly reports. But, I mean, the Republicans failed to really wage any sort of threat to Yarmuth this year in a presidential election year, where you would think that even in a place like Jefferson County, you would see some sort of anti-Obama sentiment rise, though it didn't 2 years ago. So really the narrative, I think, of this race isn't the race between Yarmuth and Wicker. It will be what happened to the Kentucky over the Jefferson County Republican Party.
But the, and now they're split. I mean, they're split between two congressional districts. The Eastern Jefferson County, which is the hotbed, the base of the
con- the money base, yeah.
Yeah, the money base, the candidate base. I mean, you're talking about Todd Lally, you know, he's
and Northup.
Out, and Northup's out there. She's, you know, actually closer to Odom County. You have you know, if Hal Hunter wanted for say to run for Congress, he can't do it. He's in the 4th district now. So redistricting really, I mean, what was probably already a fractured local party, redistricting has basically torn the sheet.
Take the cream out of the crop.
I mean, they don't have the money base. They don't have the candidate base that they've had. I mean, they're struggling for an identity.
All right, let's move down to some state legislative races. There are some interesting primaries. A couple of names that are familiar here in Louisville. Doug Hawkins and Chris Thieneman Phillip seeking their party's nomination for state senate in the 7th district.
This is a dream race. I mean, those who pay attention to local politics realize that Chris Thieneman, political activist, Doug Hawkins, a former metro councilman, two sort of firebrand Republicans in the South End. But surprisingly, this race hasn't got that much attention. It hasn't been the fireworks that we had anticipated. That initially was my thought when, you know, and I think part of that has to do with how redistricting went in Frankfort. There was this confusion. Are you in the district? Are you out of the district? Who's in? Who's out? And surprisingly, Doug Hawkins has done not as best of a job as fundraising as Thieneman has. So I think it's safe to say that Thieneman is the favorite in this. Which, you know, and people remember Doug Hawkins did run for this seat, I believe, 4 years ago while he was still on the Metro Council. So what many political observers thought was going to be this sort of great bash of hyperbolic conservative Republican activists here has turned out to be sort of another snooze race where it's expected Thieneman will win.
It's almost like Doug Hawkins isn't even running. He's raised, I think, around $250 in the entire campaign, which is extremely hard to raise that little money if you expect to have a chance of winning.
Yeah, that's like Connie Marshall numbers.
What's really
for a mayoral candidate and conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, what's really going to be interesting is this general election matchup, because even if Hawkins pulled out something amazing, it's a rematch of a basically what was a special election a few years ago. And if Thieneman wins, you've got someone who, you know, a lot of Democrats in that district would say is kind of extreme and crazy. And then you have the incumbent, Perry Clark, which a few Republicans and maybe even a few Democrats would say is extreme and crazy. So at least we'll have, maybe if we didn't get it in the primary, we might get some of that crazy in the general
election.
Yeah,
I think on the crazy spectrum, I think the incumbent wins if it's Thieneman versus Clark on that end.
Yeah, and we were really hoping for the Hawkins versus Perry Clark rematch, but that would be the most entertaining race in the city. But it looks like we might not get that.
Just have a few minutes left. Let's talk about Tim Shaughnessy's seat in the Kentucky Senate, the Democrat from Louisville not running for re-election, and quite a contested race there.
Yeah, you have Morgan McGarvey, who is a young lawyer who worked in Jack Conway's attorney general's office. And he has the endorsement of people like Crit Llewellyn and Tim Shaughnessy. And he's been able to raise much more money, I believe double all of the other candidates combined in the race. And probably the top challenger to Morgan McGarvey is Sarah Lynn Cunningham, who has the endorsement of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and the Sierra Club, and also Representative Jim Wayne out of Louisville. And then you also have Amy Shoemaker, who received the endorsement from the Fairness Campaign's PAC, and also Gary Demling, who's a local golf instructor. But it looks like those two candidates don't really have a lot of money. It looks like it's going to be a fight between McGarvey and Cunningham, probably, to see who gets out of that primary.
And that is the 19th district in the Kentucky Senate. Let's move down before we run out of time to the Metro Council. Phillip, of course, we've been focusing on the 1st district race at a big debate earlier this week.
Yes, and that debate, I think, shows some interesting things. Now, District 1 and the Metro Council, the reason we're having a special election, obviously, the removal of Councilman Green last year has made a special election in that race. Incumbent Attica Scott, who was appointed by the council last year, she has four challengers: Ray Barker, a senior former Louisville police officer, Rosa Macklin, a small businesswoman, Janice Carter Miller, a former entertainer and substitute teacher at Jefferson County Public Schools, and Stephen Colston, U of L mechanic from Southwest Louisville. So, in this race, what's interesting, and we'll talk about this later, obviously, in the show, but how you see Scott and Barker sort of jockeying a little bit after these recent violence and rash of shootings in West Louisville. I think still Scott's race to win, because think about it. If you're a Judy Greene voter from just 2 years ago, you're not voting for Ray Barker. Ray Barker is the person who filed the complaint against Councilwoman Greene that ultimately led to her ouster. But you're really not voting for Attica Scott either, because she hasn't really warmed up to her. So those voters are split, and I think that benefits Scott because you don't have a base of voters who are against you. I don't think the winner of this race probably break 50%, maybe 40, 45. But I think it's still Scott's race to lose. But I think this shooting may change that dynamic. I mean, Barker is a former police officer, anti-gang activist. He knows what he's talking about on these issues. And it's happening at the best time for him, given it's only a few days before the election.
And very quickly, and the shooting can come into play here, the Commonwealth Attorney Dave Stengel not seeking re-election, so there are several candidates for his seat.
Yeah, talk about having that being interesting. I mean, you have the Commonwealth Attorney's race, which obviously was embroiled in a little issue earlier this year with one of the candidates, Tom Vander Rostein, who's an assistant now, and this issue with James Mallory, and allowing him to be an informant and sort of seeming like getting immunity in that situation. That hasn't got that much conversation, obviously, in the press and the media. It's not clear if this shooting will bring that conversation back up again, because it doesn't seem clear any connection between these pair of shootings and the James Mallory case. But still, people in the community are definitely talking about how there's a connection between sometimes prosecutors giving certain informants and people cases over others, and how that plays out in the street. So that may pop up, but not until after the election.
Well, the polls open Tuesday at 6 a.m. Secretary of State Alison Lundergan Grimes, I think, predicting a whopping about 12% turnout for
Tuesday. And that's the high end.
Yeah, that's the high end. We hope it's much better. All right, Joe Sanka of Leo Weekly, Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, and Philip M. Bailey of WFPL. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL.
Support for WFPL comes from First Step name brand shoes, operated by Phil Carrero, who sells and repairs all kinds of shoes, including Birkenstock. First Step has dress, casual, and athletic footwear. Recent shipments include trail shoes, spring deck shoes, and hiking boots. First Step shoes at Baxter and Highland Avenues. From Churchill Downs hosting the Paddock Concert Series, this evening with the bluesy hip-hop tang sound of Citizen Cope. Gates open at 1:30, first race at 2:45, and the after-races concert begins around 8. More at churchilldowns.com. From the Speed Art Museum and its new exhibition Inside Out, illustrating how art and nature will connect after the Speed's renovation and expansion. Inside Out includes a collection of prints made by sculptors Richard Serra, Saul LeWitt, Kiki Smith, Jim Dine, and more. Details at speedmuseum.org.
You're listening to Byline on 89.3 WFPL. Coming up on Science Friday, we'll take a look at advancements in dealing with paralysis. Science Friday at 2.
Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Heldet. Yesterday, three people were killed and three others injured in two apparently related shooting incidents that occurred within about a two-hour span in Louisville's Parkland neighborhood. The incidents have city, neighborhood, and church leaders vowing to take action to help put a stop to such violence. And we just learned this afternoon that Louisville Metro Police report two men were shooting at each other in the area around Shawnee High School a short time ago. The school was already on heightened security, and police were in foot pursuit shortly afterward. And watch our website, listen to our newscast for developments on that. We don't know if that's related to yesterday's violence, but we will try to find out. Well, here to talk about all of this is WFPL's Devin Katayama, and Philip M. Bailey is back with us, both of whom reported on the shootings. Devin, let's go back to about 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon on South 32nd Street. What happened?
Well, I mean, it unraveled really quickly. We started seeing reports of shots fired. We weren't quite sure how many people were injured at the time. There were varying reports depending on which news organizations you were referring to. But what essentially happened is that police responded to a shooting where there were two individuals who were shot. Another one was taken to the hospital. The two individuals that were shot were both males, and they both were deceased. What happened is that when police, around 70 to 100 police and residents were on the streets dealing with that current shooting or the previous shooting, another shooting took place at that time. Two women, one woman shot the other woman, killed her on the spot. An officer who was on scene shot that woman and injured her as well.
So police have indicated, I guess nothing's official yet, but these right. two incidents obviously probably related.
Likely related. Yeah.
But we don't know exactly what prompted the first incident.
No, and today they had another press conference. Yesterday they had a lengthy press conference as well. Police Chief Conrad was Steve Conrad was very reluctant to kind of give away any details of the case just as yet. I think partly because they don't really know what a lot of the motives or any of the motives were really, why this happened, why the second shooting happened. So he was very careful in his wording today, not to give away too much of what they might suspect.
And Philip, you heard from Mayor Fisher last night. He had some reaction to it.
Yeah, the mayor came out, as many predicted, and condemned the shootings. Him and Police Chief Conrad both said this is something that they do not accept as far as the level of violence that was displayed in West Louisville yesterday. I think what we're seeing is a situation where, unlike some other homicides, where it's sort of an isolated incident, maybe isolated to that particular neighborhood, this began to spill over into different sectors. You saw Jefferson County Public Schools had to close down certain bus stops because kids were being let out in that area, so they weren't going to allow that. Then the hospitals had to be a heightened security because some of these individuals, some were the perpetrators, some were the supposed victims, were both being transported, and their supporters or family members were going to the hospital. And then you had the situation where, to be quite honest, this brazen shooting the resulted in the death of Makeba Lee. She was the young woman who was murdered yesterday, where another young lady, and I guess both of these women were somehow, sources say, were involved with some of the perpetrators or and or victims of the crime, the first shooting. They get into an altercation, and the young lady pulls out the gun and shoots her in front of hundreds of people, police officers, and basically every member of the media in the city of Louisville. So a public execution, really, in front of police while the police chief is on the scene. So I think all of the elements added together certainly are bringing a political forefront to this and bringing a political tint to it. But really there's a situation, as Devin mentioned earlier, where what are the details of the case? Who are the players involved? And already we're already seeing some armchair sociology a bit, why it happened by community leaders and stop the violence and those usual things we see. But I think reporters and investigators are still wanting to know certain details about who was involved, who was on whose side, who was killed, and for what reason, to get a better understanding of it before we just sort of launch into another anti-violence movement.
And Devin, you went to a meeting this morning of Mayor Fisher and some other community leaders.
Yeah, right? a bunch of West Louisville community leaders met with the mayor. Mayor Fisher was saying this was really a touch base kind of meeting. They just wanted to make sure the communication was flowing. And I think partly because the case relies so much on people who might have been around during the second shooting, tons of people who were on scene, they're really going to ask people, and they're asking people for help with figuring out what happened. We have a piece of audio that we're going to be playing right now. It pretty much summarizes how things went today.
The purpose of this morning was not to solve the problem of violence and gun violence in America or in our city. We have ongoing methods and forums to do that, but the purpose of this morning was to check in with each other, to understand, are we communicating in the right way to the right people?
Our investigation is continuing. Investigators did work on into the night and are back at it today. We know that there were a number of people on the street during the altercation that led to the first shooting. We haven't identified all of those people, and any one of them may have information that is unique to them and their perspective of that incident that could be very important to us as we move forward in our criminal investigation. So it is important, I can't stress enough, that we still have unanswered questions. And we're not going to be able to answer those questions without more information.
A lot of times people are going to be reluctant to answer that door when they know that their neighbors may be watching. We are concerned about people not giving us information for fear that they may be retaliated against themselves.
We want to encourage our families to make use of the various resources that are available in our community. We are working on grief counseling and other opportunities of various pastors and ministries. And agencies that you see represented today are here for you. Let's look at the things that we can do in our neighborhoods to uplift our neighborhood and prove to us all collectively that we are about life. We do not want death.
And what you heard in the middle there was Police Chief Steve Conrad asking for community support. He says there's going to be three phases to the reaction to the shootings. The first phase, obviously, is the investigation, which is ongoing. The second phase is going to be the continued police presence in that area. And the third phase is going to be the communication between community members and the city. And part of that is the community developing and showing what resources are available to people in that community if they need help.
But really quickly, that's the point of contention that residents have, I think, with some of these cases, is that people do cooperate with the police department in Louisville and with prosecutors. I mean, that's a misnomer that people do not. 574 LMPD is one of the most successful things that this department has done, and people use that line oftentimes. The complaint you hear from residents is, what happens when I cooperate with police about a crime and I'm intimidated, or my family members are threatened, or I am either attempted murder, or members of my family have been killed? That is what people are saying from this situation we see, where we had a crime scene, people who were involved were out in public having a very emotional reaction, some of them being witnesses and telling the media what they heard, and then literally a shooting happening right then and there. For many residents, the complaint is, I'll cooperate with police, but what assurances can I have that I can go back to my community afterwards once the case is settled, whether you solve the case, don't solve the case, whether it's prosecuted or not? Where are the broken pieces being picked up after the situation in dealing with law enforcement?
And again, we don't know if there's any connection at all, but Louisville Metro Police say two men were shooting at each other in the area around Shawnee High School a short while ago, and the school was already on heightened security and, of course, is taking all the security precautions as this unfolds. Police were in foot pursuit shortly afterward. Again, watch our website and listen to our newscast for updates. We're going to switch gears now here on Byline on WFPL. WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson has joined us because she's been reporting on a big development this week. Several months after a state audit revealed numerous problems with Louisville's Metropolitan Sewer District, the task force appointed by Mayor Greg Fisher has submitted its recommendations. First of all, Erica, welcome.
Thanks, Rick.
What was the goal here with this task force?
Well, basically, the goal was when this audit was released, it showed all of these problems with MSD. I mean, there were some kind of egregious money management issues as well as ethical problems. MSD has been addressing that over the past couple of months, and they've rectified a number of the problems. They have a new ethics policy, stuff like that. But that basically got Mayor Greg Fisher to suggest that this task force that he appointed with, you know, experts from various fields to take a look at the operations of MSD as well as Louisville Water and Metro Public Works. And a lot of them, you know, they have the same, there are definitely overlaps in what all of them do, and see if there were some ways that they could combine in some ways those duties and be more efficient.
So what did they find? Is there this possibility that this is going to happen?
Yeah, they found that there were a lot of overlaps, and they're basically recommending a merger between MSD and Louisville Water, but they're recommending that in kind of a phased approach. Phase one is basically to do what they call an interlocal agreement to have some of the departments start sharing things. I mean, some examples are purchasing, where you maybe don't need three different purchasing departments, and that includes Metro Public Works in that. Fleet maintenance, you know, you don't need three sets of mechanics, things like that. Phase two includes some slightly greater sharing. And then phase three would be a merger of Louisville Water and MSD.
So is there an estimate of what kind of cost savings there would be with this merger?
Yeah. Right now they just have estimates, of course, and they think it could eventually, there are going to be costs in the first couple of years to implement it. After that, they say it'll save anywhere from $14 million a year to $24 million a year.
And anytime you have a merger, there's usually a duplication of employees, mm-hmm. you know, the services that they provide. What would it mean for employees of the two agencies?
Well, Mayor Greg Fisher said he wasn't able to talk about that yet. But basically what they're hoping is that that's going to be managed through attrition, which just, you know, people will retire, people will quit for other reasons, and they won't be replaced. And we do have, you know, at least probably a 5-year lead time on that. So there's some time to prepare.
All right. Thank you so much, Erica. Devin Katayama, let's go back to you. You covered the meeting, Metro Council Planning and Zoning Committee meeting this week, at which the changes to the landmarks ordinance were to be voted on, but nothing happened.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise to council committee members even that were there. They were expecting that there would be amendments proposed and voted out of the committee. That didn't happen. Councilman David Yates wasn't able to go to that meeting, and he's the sponsor of the proposed landmarks ordinance. And essentially, just to remind people, that ordinance would say that Metro Council has final say over anything that becomes a landmark in the city and county. And it would also say that with the 200 signatures needed for a petition, 101 of those, just slightly over half, would have to come from residents living within a mile. Now, that's been at the crux of the big controversy, as well as the Metro Council having final say. And over the past few weeks, people have been trying to, opponents of the measure, have been trying to come up with their own ideas. And Tom Owen, who's been working with a few people, constituents, but also people that have some sort of leg in the landmarks game, he came with his proposal today, which mirrored the proposal that he sort of introduced last meeting. What that would do would basically say Metro Council does not have final say over what becomes a landmark, but it would compromise in the fact of giving 50 signatures weight to the residents within a one-mile radius. And that was really the big change that we saw this week. Now, it's going to be, you know, it's expected that next time, next committee meeting in a couple of weeks, these proposals will be on the table. Councilman Tom Owen said that gives him another 2 weeks to kind of solidify that compromise. I asked him if, you know, Councilman Yates was willing, if he thought Councilman Yates was willing to sign on to his ordinance. He said, no way, not without that Metro Council not having final say. And if you look at it, Councilman Yates, the measure has a lot of support, or it had a lot of support. It's been through a couple changes. But, it, you know, there's 10 council members who were co-sponsors to that ordinance, so it'll be interesting to see.
Well, Councilman Yates wasn't able to attend this big meeting. Did it have anything to do with it being tabled?
You know, it did. Well, his not being there was reason why they gave for it being tabled. He had apparently had some court date to present in court.
Okay. So have we reset a date for him to consider it again?
My best guess would be that it would be at the next council meeting. I haven't seen the agenda come up yet, but that would be my best guess. It seems like they really want to get this thing out there. There was, again, strong support against the ordinance at this past committee meeting. Now, public comment period is over, so people aren't going to be, they're not going to be allowed to speak unless it's a special circumstance anymore. But there, you could still see some supporters coming out for that.
All right. Speaking of Metro Council, and thank you, Devin. Mm-hmm. Philip Bailey. It came out this week. Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin announced that she had fired her grandson from his job in her office after it was revealed that he'd been in a lot of trouble and actually was getting paid while in jail. Where do we stand on this right now?
Well, Councilwoman Shanklin, and let me say first that somewhere Councilwoman Judy Green has to be pleased. people remember that Councilwoman Green brought this issue up actually last year in the midst of her ethics controversy. The issue really was that before the ethics ordinance was amended, Councilwoman Shanklin had hired her grandson, Gary Bowler, to work in her office as a part-time legislative aide at $34,000. Now, people will say part-time, $34,000. Council members can pay their legislative aides really whatever pay grade they want. Some are paid $22,000. Some have been paid as much as $70,000. It's really up to the council person. So anyway, so Councilwoman Shanklin has had, you know, she was saying she was trying to help her grandson out, and she felt betrayed by him and disappointed in him. The fact is that Gary Bowler will probably be prosecuted by the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, considering he violated his probation with his recent arrest on Derby Day, and she terminated him as a result. Now, the political ramifications for Councilwoman Shanklin are that she has a primary contest coming up on Tuesday as well against Yvonne Woods and Rose Robinson in the Democratic primary. She swiftly acted in the situation to fire her grandson after she more and more reports were coming out, one in which was that Mr. Bowler was paid while incarcerated at one point, still being paid with taxpayer dollars while being in jail, I believe a few years ago. So this situation, I think, has brought up the new issue with ethics all over again. Councilman Ken Fleming, Republican, who initially pushed for ethics reform back in 2008, is saying once again this shows that we still have some loopholes that we need to sort of clog up and dealing with family members in particular. He feels like no relative should be allowed to work in these legislative offices, whether they're supervised by the council person or not. No telling whether this will hurt Councilwoman Shanklin in her election. It's likely not, considering that Yvonne Woods and Rose Robinson have run against her previously without much success. But still, I think it shows once again that there are some issues going on in Metro Council. More and more people are paying attention to that. And like I said, I think Councilwoman Green has had another one of her arguments, at least on her supporters' mind, vindicated in the sense that she said, hey, this is not just me who's doing this. That's not a valid excuse for, obviously, her to get away with what she was guilty of. But still, she pointed out these things, at least alluded to them in public, and it's now come to light for Councilwoman Shanklin.
Now, Councilwoman Shanklin's grandson had been arrested, what, 3 dozen times during his...
Since 2003,
like
31 times. And even while, you know, his on-and-off job status as a legislative aide in her office still sort of had legal problems. And you see that argument. I mean, I think during the District 1 debate, we talked about crime. People were saying, well, it's just about jobs. Well, Gary Bowler was given a job, a $34,000 job. Mm-hmm. I think a job in which most people in this recession would love to have. And yet, he was still involved in criminal activity, ongoing, off again. So there's a question of people who have this argument of, well, it's just jobs these people need. Well, if that was the case, then why did Gary Bowler continue to have problems on and off? So I think that argument, there's a bit of cracks in it if we look at it through the prism of what happened in Councilwoman Shanklin's office. Not to debunk that argument altogether, but I think it does certainly maybe jab that argument in the chin a little bit when you say, well, these people out here are committing crimes, all they need is a job. Well, you can give the person a $34,000 job. It doesn't always work out that way.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip and Devin Katayama and Erica Peterson for joining us for our Metro segment. This is Byline on WFPL. China has embarked on a project to jumpstart its aerospace industry, spending $250 billion toward that end. James Fallows, a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a frequent contributor to NPR, has written a new book about it called China Airborne. He's coming to Louisville next week to speak at the Free Public Library on May 23rd, and we caught up with him by phone this week in San Francisco. In the book, you compare the growth of the aerospace industry in China to the development of the railroads in this country in the 19th century, which was huge.
Right. There's something similar in terms of, you know, the continental ambition of pulling the country together and also having a big technological surge. There also is an aspect that somebody pointed out to me recently, which is just as Chinese coolie labor built the American railroads to a great extent, there's a kind of foreign coolie labor that's involved in getting the Chinese aerospace industry underway. So certain cycles of history.
How big of a boom are we talking about here?
We're talking about an infrastructure boom that's unlike anything the U.S. has seen in quite a long while. For example, in the entire continental U.S., there are a couple of airports being built now. In China, there are more than 100 that are now under construction. And the idea is that most of the new airliners that are going to be bought in the world over the next two decades are planned to be sold there. Most of the development work for infrastructure, for guidance systems, for environmental efforts, too. So the center of gravity and emphasis in this important industry has shifted to China for the next while as they try to catch up in their aerospace structure.
In this book, you write about the 12th five-year plan. What is that?
Well, the whole idea of five-year plan sounds somewhat preposterous to American ears because we think of it as some sort of Soviet leftover. In China, they take these things quite seriously, and the one that's in force now, the so-called 12th five-year plan, is designed to help China move from what has been successful for the last 30 years to what they're envisioning as an entirely different way to develop their economy. Over the last 30 years, it's mainly been, as your listeners know, low-wage factories and highways and cities and infrastructure and construction. And there's some fear in China that this is pushing them into what is known there as a low-wage trap, where they're good at a certain low niche of the world's work, but they don't ever take the next step up towards becoming a richer country. So this 12th five-year plan is supposed to emphasize high-tech industries, clean energy, pharmaceuticals, and aerospace. Those are the big emphases of the effort now.
Now you've lived in China, spent a lot of time there, and you write in the book about, you know, getting from point A to point B by various methods. How has the aerospace industry changed in the short time since, you know, you've been there?
Well, it's transformed in one way and is still on the verge of transformation in another. Over the, you know, anybody who was in China 20 or 25 years ago knows how ramshackle and often unsafe air travel was. They had these old Soviet leftover airliners. It looked like there were holes in the fuselage. They probably weren't, but it was sort of like a flying bus in those days, sort of a third world bus. Now Chinese airlines are on average, you could say, nicer than many American airlines because they have all new equipment and they give you hot meals on every flight and all of that. So the airline world has really transformed quickly. Something that hasn't developed and is one of these frontiers for seeing what's going to happen to China is the kind of business aviation that is familiar across the U.S., where you have business jets and you have courier services, you have small plane pilots. That is something that's just in its rudimentary stages in China, largely because the military still controls almost all the airspace. So you see a fascinating battle between the rising business interests in China, these people who want to fly to their factories or have the kind of network of connections the U.S. does, and the military that doesn't want to have this sort of out-of-control activity. And the direction of that battle is one of several proxies for which force is going to be paramount in China.
Well, the name of the book is China Airborne. James Fallows is the author. James, we look forward to meeting you next week, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me this opportunity. I look forward to being there.
James Fallows will speak at the Louisville Free Public Library May 23rd. More information is at our website, wfpl.org. Coal-producing states like Kentucky are warily eyeing federal regulations that have begun moving the country away from fossil fuels. Even so, Sue Tierney says she thinks coal will be around for a while, though it will be cleaner and make up less of the nation's energy mix. Tierney was the Assistant Secretary for Policy in the U.S. Department of Energy under President Bill Clinton. She's also the sister of our previous interview subject, James Fallows. Coincidentally, she's giving a talk in Louisville next week on energy and the policies at play in both the U.S. and China. And she spoke with WFPO's Erica Peterson about what exactly sustainable energy is.
If you like to think of a Venn diagram, I think of sustainable energy as a category or a way to characterize energy supplies, which is highly efficient, a relatively light footprint on the environment, provides a way for people to have affordable energy supplies over time. Now, clearly, renewable energy sources, as they get bigger and bigger, are likely to be more affordable and part of that package. And clearly, they're good for the environment in so many ways.
So, I mean, is there a way fossil fuels could ever be sustainable energy?
Yes. If you're like me and you think that climate change is happening, and you are a pragmatist and you think that the major countries of the world have enormous fossil fuel endowments, that we have to get to a point where we are including fossil fuels in a lighter way from the point of view of issuing greenhouse gas emissions. So that means we really need to get technologies done like carbon capture and sequestration and even much more efficient power generation systems so that we can move to better align use of fossil fuels with global, you know, climate change concerns.
So, I mean, that sounds like a lot of what you're saying is a balance, and a smaller percentage with better technology that doesn't wreak such havoc on climate.
That sounds like a great way to characterize it. We waste a lot of energy by virtue of lots of different ways in which our buildings are built and cars. And also we've had insufficient incentives to really tighten our belts about making sure that we're using energy as efficiently as possible.
And I mean, does that incentivizing mean necessarily higher rates?
It might mean higher rates, but it doesn't necessarily mean higher bills. So if you think about this issue, people where I live, which is Boston, have very high electricity rates, especially compared to people in Kentucky. But over the years, we've had much bigger economic incentives to tighten our belts, you know, to tighten up the windows, to put in light bulbs that are more efficient, and so on and so forth. And as a result of that, the average bill of an electricity customer across a year is actually lower than the average bill, again, for a residential customer, in parts of the country where electricity rates are really low.
Well, Sue, is there anything else you want to talk about?
I'm so interested to know that the World Affairs Council in Louisville invited me specifically to come and talk about the sustainable energy issues in the U.S. as we think about it in comparison to China. They're investing so much more than we are in the United States on some of these technologies. It is, of course, a central government there, but one of the aspects of that is that they've been able to set high targets for adopting renewable energy, set high targets for reducing energy use in their major industries, including really heavy industry. And so they're getting very efficient, and they're really banking on some of these new technologies having markets globally. They are doing a lot. I wish we were racing with them on some of those things. Of course, they are burning a lot of coal, and so that they also are trying to think about how to do that in a cleaner fashion. Their air pollution is just leagues worse than ours is. And I thought it was really interesting that the World Affairs Council wants to hear about the contrast between our countries and what we might learn from each other.
That was former Assistant Secretary for Policy at the U.S. Department of Energy, Sue Tierney, speaking with WFPL's Erica Peterson. Tierney's visit to Louisville next week is sponsored by the World Affairs Council. She'll speak at the Green Building Monday evening at 6:30. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL.
Support for WFPL comes from the Louisville Independent Business Alliance, presenting the Buy Local First Fair, featuring locally owned, operated boutiques, shops, galleries, restaurants, breweries, a farmer's market, music, an Iron Chef competition, kids area, and more, this Sunday at the Louisville Water Tower. Details at keeplouisvilleweird.com. For Macy Entertainment, presenting the Shenzhen Concert with the Antlers, Saturday, June 9th at 8 at the Iroquois Amphitheater. Tickets at ticketfly.com, the Iroquois box office, or 368-5063. From Julep's Catering, a full-service professional catering company providing event coordination for gatherings and corporate activities from intimate events to hundreds anywhere in the metro area. Information at julepsoflouisville.com or 454-4499.
You're listening to Byline on 89.3 WFPL. Coming up on Science Friday, we'll take a look at the latest advancements that have been made in dealing with paralysis. Plus, we'll find out what SpaceX is up to. That's a two.
Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Hellett, and as we normally do at this time of the program, Aaron Keene, our WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter, joins us. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Welcome back. Well, a lot going on. First of all, the Spalding University MFA program, Festival of Writing, starts tomorrow and runs, what, for another week or so?
Yeah, for about a week. This is a really exciting time. Our studios are here on 4th Street, and today is when a lot of the writers start to arrive for this 10-day festival. And so you can just sort of feel a different kind of energy down here. It's the Spalding's MFA program is a brief residency program. So twice a year, writers gather on Spalding's campus for these 10-day very intense residencies. And part of that, the festival part of that, are public readings that are given mostly by the faculty of the graduate program. And then later there are some alumni and some guests also who read.
This has really picked up over the years. This event has really gained a lot of momentum.
Yeah, well, the faculty has grown as the program has grown. So now, geez, I mean, there are like a few dozen writers who are all reading. And the cool thing also is that the program really asks the faculty to read from new work, not just from, you know, the stuff that folks have heard before. So you're likely to hear, you know, something that's even unpublished from a writer that you might be really fond of. Some of the folks who are coming up this week. Diane April is on faculty, so for those who are used to reading her.
Oh, that's a familiar name.
Yeah. So she's in Seattle now, but she still comes back twice a year. So you can catch her on Saturday at 6:45. You know, and so her latest book is The Eye Is Not Enough on Seeing and Remembering, but you might hear a brand new essay from Diane at this reading that you never heard before. So that's always exciting.
And we have this collaboration between Silas House and
Neela Vaswani. Yes. Yeah, Silas and Neela are good friends. They're collaborators, and they got together. They're both on faculty at Spalding. They both teach fiction writing, and they got together a couple of years ago to write an epistolary novel for middle grade readers, which is a novel in letters. So Neela had a character in mind who was a 12-year-old kid from India whose family immigrated to New York. They live in Chinatown. And she said, "Hey, Silas, do you want to work with me on this?" So he develops a character, River, who's a basketball star in Eastern Kentucky and the son of a coal miner. And they end up, you know, signing up through a school pen pal program and send each other letters over the course of a whole year. And so House and Vaswani actually wrote the book like that. Didn't discuss plot ahead of time, didn't talk back channel, you know, about the development of the book. They wrote each other letters in character. And over the course of one school year, they did it in real time in 2008. So
wow.
The book just came out in February. And that's part of the celebration of recently published books by faculty. So one evening out of the festival is really all about the new book that's just come out. And that's Sunday. So you'll see them read together actually for the first time. They've been splitting up their book tour duties. Silas in the South and Midwest, Neela on the East Coast because she lives in New York. And so they're actually going to be reading together on Sunday. It's pretty cool.
Now, is there a cost to attend this?
No, yeah. They're all free. Most of the readings are happen at Spalding University. Some of them happen at the Brown Hotel because that's the sort of the official residence hall of the program. So you can go to the Spalding website, and later on this afternoon, also on WFPL.org, click on Arts and Humanities, and we'll have a whole schedule available as well. But everything's free and open to the public.
Now, you had the unique, moving on to another topic, you had the unique privilege earlier this week to see William Shatner who came to Louisville?
I did. Me and about 200 of our closest friends. He actually, he and his wife donated a sculpture to the Fraser History Museum. And his wife, Elizabeth, is a former horse trainer. And she and Bill own a horse farm outside of Versailles where they raise horses. So they have a pretty deep Kentucky connection. They live here part of the year. And they commissioned a statue, a limited edition statue of a samurai on horseback riding into battle called Way of Horse and Bow by Dow Blumberg. And he's a Kentucky sculptor, a former horse trainer himself. So it's a really, really lovely thing that the Shatners did to gift this sculpture to the Fraser while they have this samurai history exhibit that's open right now through September.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What's in this exhibit?
Oh, lots of cool stuff. You know, it fits right in with when the Fraser was created first, it was an arms museum. So the samurai, there's definitely an emphasis on the warrior culture there and of the sort of, armor and weaponry and stuff like that. But there's also an emphasis on the beauty and artistic culture of that as well. So you're going to see a lot of scroll work and really great calligraphy, and then also the sort of historical vestments and such that folks would wear into battle.
Now, I guess I assume this is William Shatner's first public visit to the Fraser. Did he get a chance to look around at the exhibit?
He did, actually. And those of us who were still hanging around, because I wanted to see the exhibit, were invited to come up and kind of follow him and his wife while he was up there. He's been doing this for so long that he is really good at ignoring a bunch of TV cameras in his face.
Oh, yeah.
But folks might have seen the B-roll of that if they were watching the newscast on Tuesday. But yeah, they got a real kick out of it. He was really, really into it. He's a big Japanese history buff, as it turns out. So this was really a confluence, this sculpture, of a lot of their different interests. You have Elizabeth's longtime interest in horses. You have Bill's interest in Japanese history. And so they kind of came together in the commissioning of the statue.
All right. Again, that's samurai exhibits at the Fraser Museum. And finally, artist Ryan McGinnis is appearing this evening in town.
Yeah, this is a cool series that 21C Museum has been putting on. They've brought in maybe about half a dozen artists since January to come in and just do this lecture series at 21C. Now, this particular artist was also brought in by Land of Tomorrow Gallery. So this is the second collaboration that the two organizations have done. I think this is a really nice example of how bigger arts organizations can work with the smaller galleries or the smaller orgs to partner, to bring someone in who's going to appeal to both of their audiences or constituencies. Ryan McGinnis is... a lot of the work that he does is very calls to mind things like graphic and logo design.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see his women's series is these figural drawings that are sort of flattened and sort of solid colored, kind of like a Matisse almost. But then there's something about them that is also sort of incorporates. You'll look at that and you'll think, is that the United Way logo in her head? You know, not quite, but but reminiscent of that. And so I think artwork like that sort of challenges how we kind of look at advertising and things like that in our everyday world.
All right, Erin Keene, thank you very much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Rick.
That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL staff. Our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Hallett. Have a good weekend.